Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
They came to a large tree and it could have gone either right or left, and he went left and stumbled on the bones and originally thought it was perhaps pig, and then on closer examination saw a skull.
Kia ora, I'm Jesse Mulligan and this is Crimes NZ Season 6. And if you're new to the podcast, Crimes NZ is where I talk with people connected in some way or other with New Zealand's most notorious crimes. To kick this season off, we're speaking with former police officer Wayne Kiley, who worked the case of 23-year-old Robert James Garwaith, whose body was found by pig hunters in the Coromandel in 1987. As police were to discover, this was not your average murder mystery, but a crime with links back to the infamous Mr. Asia drug syndicate.
There was a team of, I think, 15 or 20 detectives plus uniform support.
Big deal at the time?
It was. We had a string of whodunit murders in Hamilton at the time and in the Coromandel area. So this was just an ongoing, continuing homicide investigations for the Hamilton COB.
Okay. Was this around the same time as the Swedish tourists?
They came a bit later.
Were they? Okay.
But we had a series of homicides in the previous 2 years in the area, and this was just another one.
What were the circumstances under which the body was found?
So two pig hunters, it was very lucky to be found. It was down the Tepu Cora Glen Road, is quite a isolated dirt road. Two pig hunters had chased a pig and their dogs, and they did, instead of going back through the bush, they decided to walk up the road. And the body was on a very steep embankment, and they decided to walk up to the road rather than walk back through the bush. And they came to a large tree, and it could have gone either right or left. And he went left and stumbled on the bones, and originally thought it was perhaps pig, and then on closer examination saw a skull. And called the police. So we were extremely lucky that it was found at all.
Yeah. And did it immediately line up with someone who you knew was missing at the time?
No, there were no missing person reports. The victim, Robert Garwaith, was quite a transient and wandered around the countryside, so he hadn't actually been reported missing. Mm. So
how was the body identified?
Forensically, through dental records and an injury, he had a titanium plate from a broken arm from a tractor accident. So eventually he was identified through forensic dental work and from his injuries on his body.
Okay, and there was a bit of publicity around the case, which I think prompted somebody who noticed he was missing.
Yes, Coromandel locals, which he was very much part of that local community, contacted police and advised them that, you know, they all remembered last seeing him at a party. And one of these people was on, I think, Great Barrier Island, and contacted the police and said she had photos from that party. Oh. And that was the last time she'd recalled seeing him. And there'd been no sighting of him from that point.
Yeah. So, what sort of a guy was he?
He was a typical Coromandel lad, born and bred in Coromandel. His family lived not far out of the township, and lived all his life in the area, but also had a very transient lifestyle. It was nothing for him to go walk about for 6 months or so. No one would ever hear from him. Mm-hmm. I think from memory he used to wear bare feet a lot. So a pretty harmless and offensive person that liked a beer, I think, is how his dad described him to me.
Yeah. In fact, it turned out that he'd been spending a bit of cash on beer just before he went missing.
Correct. On the day before the day of the murder, he'd received an ACC payout, which back then I think was $2,000 or $3,000. He'd been to his lawyer, got a check, which he took to his local bank and cashed. And so I think he took out about $1,800 in cash. So he was quite flush with cash.
Yeah. Mm. Went to a party and bought them a keg. Went to another party, bought them a keg.
Correct.
Yeah. Splashing the cash.
Yes.
How strong a lead was this then, this person who you heard from who had these photos from the party?
Well, the police, we managed, it's not like today, we had to actually get the physical photos and negatives from Great Barrier Island, which police cars meeting and racing up between here and Coromandel. And as soon as they arrived at the police base at Coromandel, we took them to the local camera shop and got them developed. And when we started looking at the people at the party, many of the senior police officers identified Jennifer and Patrick Norton Bennett at the party, who were well known to police.
Okay, let's start with Jennifer Norton Bennett, because she doesn't sound like your average killer.
No, but they are a team, and Jennifer had quite a strict religious upbringing, from what I understand. And met Patrick Norton Bennett when he was a sentenced prisoner, when she was visiting with a church group, and they fell in love and got married. But certainly she'd fallen into his criminal ways over the years following.
Fallen under his spell too, by the sounds of things.
Yes, quite possibly. He was a very domineering. He was very short in stature, Patrick, quite short and quite slight, but a very intense and, I would say, quite domineering person.
Yeah. So what was his background?
Patrick, I would describe as a career criminal. He had been in trouble from a young age and went from petty offending and drug dealing. I think he started in Dunedin. And then his real rise to fame came through the Mr. Asia Syndicate. He got involved with the Mr. Asia Syndicate and travelled backwards and forwards to Australia with Terry Clark and Sinclair. They were all close associates, and he was one of their standover henchmen, by all accounts. And, you know, he was quite a serious criminal involved in that Mr. Asia environment. They offended in Australia and get sent back to New Zealand. He would offend here. He would get bail and he'd disappear back to Australia. He'd get caught committing crimes in Australia and back to New Zealand. So he was a career criminal, very much involved in the drug world.
And known as a bit of a heavy?
Very much a bit of a heavy, an enforcer. Tales of him, especially in Australia, dealing out quite severe beatings to people that cross the Mr. Asia Syndicate.
So why was he in New Zealand on this occasion?
I think he'd jumped bail in New Zealand and he'd gone to Australia. He got caught in a cannabis growing operation in Australia, got deported back to New Zealand, and he'd been wanted on warrants, as I recall. So he got sentenced on cultivation cannabis and from an incident that related to where he presented a stolen police pistol at police when they arrested him. So he got a sentence on those and he went to prison, and around this time he'd come out of prison and basically had lost everything.
That Waihee raid, by the way, pretty famous one within the police circles.
It was. The police posed as painters. They actually painted the neighbour's house to complete the surveillance. Yeah. And the neighbours got their house painted for free, as I recall, and they were watching him go to his cultivation site.
Oh, wow.
And when they did the raid, they came in through both doors, and at the same time, Mr. Asia himself was being detained in outside a local hotel, and when they crashed through the doors, he pulled out a pistol and he attempted to present it at one of the detectives, who managed to tackle him, and luckily the pistol came free.
Wow.
Very lucky.
Okay, so anyway, he's in jail at this point, mostly in Pirimoremo, but he's in Mount Eden on remand, and there's an attempted prison break.
Yes, that was quite a famous, because Jennifer was a getaway driver, so they were going to escape from prison, and as I recall, she arrived early, and by the time she drove around the block to come and get them, the police were there. And he still managed to escape, though, and I think he was on the run for 2 or 3 days before there was a hostage situation out at Murawai, And
so hang on, the notes I've got here, she was meant to be the getaway, but she'd slept in.
Oh, that's right.
So she came late.
By the time she got there, the police were already there and they
looking for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And found her driving around the edge of the prison wearing a wig, looking
that's
for her
correct.
Husband.
That's correct.
And then he's found in Muriwai.
Yes. And I think there was a hostage situation, and I think the armed offender squad had to use tear gas, and he jumped out of a two-story window and was caught by a police dog.
He's what a life, eh?
Yep, he was determined to get away by the sounds of it. But as a result, I think that's when he went to prison before he came out prior to the murder.
It's pretty amazing that he keeps getting out, you know?
Yeah.
Some pretty full-on stuff here.
I don't think he ever got a very long sentence.
Mm. So how did he and Jennifer end up in Coromandel?
So they'd been, upon his release from prison, him and Jennifer were living in the Glen Innes area in Auckland. And during that time, they didn't have a lot of money, and they were known for standing over associates and criminals in the area, stealing stuff, taking VCRs as they were in those days and selling them. And they were very much involved, and they were certainly, and there was a lot of police pressure on them as well. So things were getting quite hot in Auckland. He was so paranoid, we heard stories that he'd stop at a set of traffic lights and he'd run back and he'd threaten the three cars behind him because he was sure that some of them were police surveillance vehicles. And so I think things got a little bit too heated in the Glen Innes area, so they decided to move up to the quiet Coromandel township.
Presumably he was on the police radar, though, still.
The local Coromandel cop, there was only one cop in those days at Coromandel, he'd seen the vehicle driving around that they were in, and he noted down the registration number, but it wasn't until some time later that he realised who he was actually dealing with, that was actually Patrick and Jennifer Norton Bennett. And they came to a lot of attention in the Coromandel area. They were known, you know, they're famous for going to a school charity and it was a $70 entry fee or something. And they threatened, they said they didn't get their money's worth and threatened the organisers. And even though the organisers knew they hadn't paid for the entrance fee, they still paid them the $70 because they didn't want any trouble. Mm. So they were involved in lots of petty crime in and around the Coromandel area.
And how'd they come across this Robert Goweth?
So it was at this party, they of course got involved with all the locals at the both parties where he bought kegs. It would have been quite obvious in the conversation, and we interviewed a lot of those party goers, that it was clearly common knowledge that Goweth had this sum of money, and there were rumours that he was going to get more money from ACC as well.
And so what happens? What do we know?
So what we know is that they took Goweth in their vehicle to Auckland, where they picked up a female associate. And the female associate and Goweth and the Norton Bennetts return to Coromandel. And it's at that point that the murder happened, when they were trying to get money out of Goweth, allegedly for a cannabis plantation, which was virtually non-existent across from where they were living.
So they asked him for money, he said no, and it got violent?
It got violent, and he ended up dead. And how we... It took us quite a while to figure this out. So the investigation started as we had the car. So we knew the car had been involved in the...
His car? No, their car.
I think it was a Holden Kingswood. And we knew who the registered owner was. So the initial investigations we were involved with was picking up the registered owner of that vehicle who lived in Auckland and was associate of theirs from Glen Innes. And her name was Denise Alterator. And she said that when she got the car back, there were bits cut out of the seats and everything. So obviously our suspicions were that perhaps blood was cut out of the seats. So we picked her up one night and we interviewed her for several hours at the Otahuhu police station. And she gave an account that they borrowed the vehicle and that she had travelled to Coromandel via bus, and she'd met them, and she saw the condition of her vehicle. It also around this time we were getting lots of tips from the criminal underworld that they had been involved in Gawa's homicide. So they were known to be quite boastful about their criminal offending in the criminal element, and that information was filtering through police channels back to the investigation team as well.
Sounded like a pretty horrific attack.
It was a very horrific attack. We didn't realise he had injuries of in the skull of a hammer that had been, we believed it was a ball pen hammer, one of those big heavy ball pen hammers, and the injury in his skull was very consistent that he'd been struck hard in the head with that. So we knew his death was very violent.
Mm.
With the interview of Denise Alterator, we were concerned about aspects of her explanation, but at the time we had no other evidence to doubt what she was saying. We also located a group of their associates from Auckland who gave various accounts of them saying that she would use acid. She carried hydrochloric acid with her, and or sulfuric acid, and she wouldn't hesitate at throwing acid on people. Jennifer still had a reputation as well of carrying a big long hat pin, which she said she would have no trouble putting through someone's eye. And they would show people the acid and the hat pins and tell various people. So we gathered quite a bit of evidence around their activities in Auckland before they went to Coromandel, before we finally went and saw Jennifer in Mount Eden Prison.
Gee, she's a long way from the Hamilton Baptist Church youth group at this point, isn't she?
Very much so.
Yeah.
So well,
what was her response when you put these allegations to her?
So myself and a detective sergeant visited her in Mount Eden Prison, and she sat down and asked what we wanted, and we started to explain what we were there for. And at one stage, the conversation went something like, you've got pretty big balls for putting a hat pin through someone's eye. And she said, you've got pretty big balls for accusing me of murder. And that was basically the end of the interview. So, and Patrick Norton Bennett was very similar. He refused to speak to police. So we weren't going to get anything on admission-wise out of either of the Norton Bennetts. Mm.
So you just had to gather evidence, I imagine.
Yes, we continued gathering evidence and witnesses. We had one criminal come forward, associate of theirs. He was reporting on bail in Waihee, and he'd met them around the time of the murder and had seen a ball pen hammer in their possession. And they'd made comments about using it. So we gather a very strong circumstantial case against the Norton Bennetts for the murder, and which led us to a depositions hearing, which was a pre-trial to see if we got enough evidence to send them to trial. That took place in Hamilton, in the Hamilton District Court, and the officer in charge, Detective Senior Sergeant Bruce Raffin, was the officer in charge, and he noted that in the cross-examination of the owner of the Holden, the defence counsel had attacked her quite strongly over the fact that she hadn't got a bus to Coromandel, which we'd had no reason to doubt that up until that point. So at the end of the depositions hearing, we started making inquiries with all the road transport, and we actually established that she had indeed told lies and she couldn't got a bus to Coromandel. So that then led us to think, okay, she's why would she lie? And then, because there were lots of things going through our head, but because she committed perjury, we had to then go through the Attorney General to get authority to charge anyone with perjury. I think it was about 6 o'clock one winter's evening when we got told that we had the green light. Myself and Detective Senior Sergeant Raffin travelled to Glen Innes, and we picked her up from her home address and took her to the Glen Innes police station. And what took place was quite a long 3-hour interview, which sort of ended very much with her breaking down and she admitted she'd lied, and she admitted she didn't tell us, give us any detail, but she basically, if you'd seen a human reaction to someone who'd obviously seen someone murdered, that's what we saw. She curled up on a ball on the floor, screaming. And she actually said to me afterwards, she said, "I hate you for making me remember that."
Wow. That sounds like a movie scene, but that's actually the case. She obviously put it out of her head, and you'd been the one to make her go back and relive it.
Yes. So that left us with, she got immunity from prosecution, and basically she gave evidence that she had been recruited by the Norton Bennetts and taken them to up to, she'd been taken to Coromandel where she slept with them. In the morning, they basically said, "We need your money." They went across the road. There was no cannabis plantation. Patrick grabbed Garwith from behind. She threw acid in his face and then started hitting him with a hammer. And they basically killed him on the side of the road in Coromandel. She was there, and she was made to, by Jennifer, was quite badly injured in the violent struggle. And after that, Denise was made to help Patrick dispose of the body.
So, and she testified to all
she
this.
She was a very good witness, and ended up in the conviction.
Jury found them guilty. They're both guilty
of murder.
Okay, and where are they now?
I don't know where Patrick. I think he might have got recalled to prison. Last I heard, I'm not sure, but I know Jennifer got out and her life turned around, allegedly. But one of my ex-colleagues interviewed her over this case, and she still disputes her innocence.
You've been listening to Crimes NZ with me, Jesse Mulligan. And you can find more episodes of this series on the RNZ Podcasts page. It's also on Apple, Spotify, iHeart, or wherever you catch your favourite podcasts. Follow the series so you don't miss an episode. And if you're looking for something else to listen to, you might like Gone Fishing. I'm on RNZ each afternoon from 1 till 4 with an upbeat mix of New Zealand stories, from the curious to the compelling. So tune in to RNZ National.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.